TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. From Fukushima to Solartopia, how the green-powered Earth Revolution can defeat King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas. Longtime no-nukes activist Harvey Wasserman said he was honored to speak to a full hall at the Unitarian Universalists Fellowship in Berkeley, California, on Hiroshima Day 2014. He is the culmination of his one-hour talk from his first direct engagement against nuclear power in 1973, the defeat of two reactors in the Montague Valley of Massachusetts, 4 miles from his organic farm, to his outspoken truth-telling about Fukushima. Harvey Wasserman has been an anti-nuclear campaigner and a pioneer of renewable energy. In 4 decades, he was not just an organizer and spokesperson in many anti-nuclear rebellions from the Clamshell Alliance on, but he remains fearless of being arrested in civil disobedience to this day. At the same time, he has been researching and monitoring the nuclear industry and their criminal accidents in his dozen books and many articles in Counterpunch, Huffington Post, and The New York Times. Harvey Wasserman has worked with Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, and Graham Nash since the late 1970s. They founded nukefree.org in 2007 with Wasserman as editor and stopped a proposed $50 billion loan guarantee package meant to finance new nuclear reactor construction. Nukefree.org is active and up to date. Wasserman started his Hiroshima Day talk by saying that he had good news, bad news, and really good news. The good news that he supported with numbers in part one of this program is the decline of the nuclear power industry worldwide. The bad news is Fukushima, the ongoing releases, and the irresponsible handling of the cleanup by TEPCO, a corporation neither capable nor motivated to do a proper job. Now you are about to hear some more bad news about Fukushima, followed by the really good news of the green-powered Earth. Wasserman says, "We are in the fight for our lives. We must and we can build the green-powered Earth before the next nuclear meltdown." He begins by debunking the biggest lie of nuclear power advocates that there is a safe dose. Wasserman credits the woman who made the discovery.
In 1956, one of the great heroes, one of my great heroes, and I was lucky enough to meet her once, Dr. Alice Stewart, was a British doctor, a British MD, and she undertook quite innocently to do a study of the childhood leukemia rates among British children. And she had a whole laundry list of possible factors that she checked out in an epidemiological manner, and one of the factors was x-raying women while they're pregnant. And that's the one that jumped out. And she realized in 1956 that there's essentially no safe dose of radiation, certainly not for a human fetus or an embryo, because if a single x-ray to a pregnant mother can double the childhood leukemia rate, you know, what are we talking about? So we have known since the 1950s that there's no safe dose of radiation. And so at Fukushima, the radiation releases have been horrific. We don't know exactly how much went out. We don't know exactly what its composition is, what the different isotopes are. We have a rough idea. And we don't know where it went. And we don't know, of course, who has been impacted. I have had, unfortunately, direct experience with this at Three Mile Island. At Three Mile Island, the utility company proudly announced that the amount of radiation released at Three Mile Island was, for everybody in central Pennsylvania, the equivalent of a single x-ray, as if this was a good thing. Of course, they never talked about Dr. Stewart's findings about how many pregnant women got this x-ray. But the fact is, it's utter nonsense. Radiation coming out of nuclear plants is random. It comes out down in clumps. We saw in central Pennsylvania, we saw whole neighborhoods where every house had cancer. I mean every house. And then a neighborhood a mile away had nothing, because that's just the random way that radiation comes down. We saw this again at Chernobyl. And by the way, whenever you hear them somebody saying that nobody died at Three Mile Island, do something nonviolent, okay? Because it's one of the worst lies ever told in history. I went into the central Pennsylvania a year after the accident. I may have been the only journalist stupid enough to do that. I sat and I interviewed people. It was the worst week of my life. You know, every disease you never want to hear about. I guarantee you, hundreds of people were killed at Three Mile Island. Chernobyl, the same thing, although worse. Chernobyl was much worse. The radiation came down all across Europe and all through Belarus and Ukraine. And I'm going to say something now, which is one of the worst things I've ever had to say. There are areas in Belarus and Ukraine where 20% of the children are healthy. 20% of the children are healthy. Some of you, I'm sure, have seen the pictures of the mutations and all that stuff. It's just beyond tragedy. And I will say, there has been a study done by three scientists, one of whom has passed away. They were Russians, and they compiled the 5,000 studies that were done around Chernobyl and have concluded that more than 1 million people have died as a result of Chernobyl. Now, in Fukushima, it's only 3 years out. The one thing the nuclear industry has been really, really good at over the decades is not studying the impacts of nuclear power. And they did a great job at Three Mile Island. They're doing following up very well at Chernobyl and at Fukushima. To their chagrin, there is a private university, the Fukushima Medical University. It's funded largely by the government, but they have been doing studies. They're following the health of about 400,000 children in the Fukushima area. So 3.5 years out, we now have a 40 times thyroid cancer rate among children. 40 times. Just about half of these 400,000 children have thyroid abnormalities. I wrote a piece about this, by the way. It was called Fukushima's Children Are Dying. It's at nukefree.org. I have not seen a rebuttal, which to me indicates that this is real, and they don't want to do a rebuttal because they can't deny this. And it's horrifying. I also want to mention, by the way, the guy, and I'm sorry I can't pronounce his name, the man who ran Fukushima, the plant manager. If there's ever a single human being to save millions of lives, it's this guy. He refused to leave during Fukushima. He was ordered to leave, and they were ordered to do a whole bunch of stuff and basically to abandon the plant. And this one guy refused to do it, and he probably saved millions of lives. And he has since died of esophageal cancer, unfortunately. And of course, the owners of the plant say it had nothing to do with Fukushima. So the reality is that, and this is actually the worst thing I'm going to have to say, is that I am terrified of the water pouring into the Pacific Ocean. You know, this is cesium and many other highly lethal isotopes. And the question is not, are these isotopes potentially dangerous to human life? Of course they are. We know that now. They tested 15 tuna that were caught off the coast of California. All 15 of them showed cesium from Fukushima. It can be traced. So, you know, the industry says, well, it's not enough to harm you. We know it's enough to harm us. Come on. But beyond that, we have to wonder what this radiation is going to do to the ecosystem of the Pacific Ocean. Is it going to bioaccumulate? What will it do to the algae? What will it do to the phytoplankton, to the starfish, to the sea lions, to the herring, to the salmon? This is an apocalyptic consideration, and I don't have an answer for it. I think the only thing we can do at this point in time about Fukushima is to continue to pressure some kind of global response. TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, should not continue to own Fukushima. They do not have the expertise. They don't have the incentive. There's, you know, these are corporations we're dealing with. If there's a single virus that has infected and threatened the human race, it is the corporation. This entity, this entity that has been given human rights but no human responsibilities. there is no built-in financial incentive for Tokyo Electric Power Company to clean up Fukushima. As far as they're concerned, they could stay there forever and make money on it, you know, as they did in 2013. I think they made about $8 billion in 2013. They still own Fukushima. They still have no clear interest as a corporation in cleaning it up. They have no liability. They have no damages they'll have to pay to the people downwind who are harmed. That's not sustainable. And it's true of all the reactors in the world. And so that, more than anything, is what we really have to change. I believe we can change it. Why? Because our survival is at stake. If there's one thing that is more powerful than the profit motive, it's the survival instinct. What else do we need to know? You know, what more can go wrong? So, okay, so that's the hard news. That's the real. So all of you, I hope you're not depressed. I don't know how I continue to do this every day, but I have hope. Because, if, you know, we're informed now, we know what to do. Okay, so the good news. There is actually good news from Fukushima. One piece of good news, which is a big deal. As I mentioned, when Fukushima blew up, there were 54 commercial reactors licensed to operate in Japan. Does anybody know how many commercial reactors are now operating in Japan?
Zero.
None. Not one. No, they haven't reopened. Not. They've been licensed, but they haven't reopened. It is the biggest single mass shutdown of commercial reactors in the history of the world. We need more of that. There were about 440, roughly, commercial reactors worldwide on 3/11/2011. There are now around 360, 70, 80, something like that. So now, as we move ahead into the good stuff, we do have a rapidly diminishing number of commercial reactors in the world. It is happening. We shut, like I say, 5 last year. This year, Vermont Yankee will shut. There's no doubt about it. And all the reactors in the United States are old, and they are losing their competitiveness. The Mark I's, there's 23 General Electric reactors. There's a lot of old Westinghouse reactors. We have reached the tipping point. We actually reached it in 2011, where wind and solar are cheaper than operating nuclear plants. That's a huge deal. It means you now can put in solar panels and put nuclear power plants, existing nuclear power plants, fully amortized nuclear power plants, out of business. There was a very obscure but a very key reactor that went down. It's called Kewaunee, Kewaunee, in Wisconsin. And Kewaunee had not much really of an opposition. It's up way up near Green Bay, where I own part of the football team, by the way. there you go. You know what I'm talking about. Okay. And they didn't have any major structural problems. It was just old, and it was no longer efficient, and they shut it. They couldn't get anybody to buy it, and the owners just shut it. We have dozens of reactors on the brink of that now, all across the United States, especially in Illinois. You know, Obama's from Illinois, and he was with Commonwealth Edison, which turned into Exelon. If anybody can tell me why so many utilities names sound like laxatives, I'd really like to know that. So this is Exelon, and they have a dozen reactors, and this is Obama's roots. And they are now going, talk about chutzpah, they're going into the Illinois legislature, and they're saying, we need money to continue to operate these fully amortized reactors because they fight global warming. Now, we may lose a couple of those battles. You know, Nebraska, Texas, maybe a few other states will lose, and they'll get some subsidies for a while. But Massachusetts, other states, we should win. It may even come up here. Diablo is not quite at that state yet, but it may even come up in California, where they start to ask for subsidies to operate these reactors. But if we can keep them from getting them, they will shut. Now, the other good thing that came from Fukushima, it's hard to say that, good thing coming from Fukushima, is Germany. There's been, for many years, a very powerful anti-nuclear movement, a pro-green movement in Germany. A lot of strength. And they actually forced, a number of years ago, a national decision to phase out all their nuclear plants. But then, politics being what there is, the center-right government came in for other reasons, and they stalled. It stalled. But the anti-nuclear movement, the way it happened in 2011, called for a giant national rally to force finally these reactors shut. There are 19 in Germany. And in between the calling of the rally and the rally itself, Fukushima happened. Now, Angela Merkel, the Prime Minister of Germany, is actually a chemist. And she, after Fukushima, said, we can't do this anymore. And she basically went along. And so Germany is now in the process of shutting all of its 19 reactors. 8 went down almost immediately after Fukushima. You have to remember, by the way, that Germany got heavily dosed by Chernobyl. It's a huge amount of radiation. They were not happy about it, and that's one of the reasons they got as far as they did. And so Germany shut the 8, and they're phasing out the other 11 by 2022. I think it's going to go faster. But what's really happening now in Germany, and I'm sure many of you know this, is there is a huge, very conscious, very powerful transition, national transition, being made to renewable energy, primarily solar and wind. This decision had to be agreed to by the major corporations in Germany. While most people were concerned, of course, about the health and all that stuff, the corporations think about profit, and the corporations came in Germany, Siemens most importantly, came to the conclusion that they could go with wind and solar and make more money. So this is happening. It's called Energiewende. I'm sure I butchered that. Anybody in Germany who speaks German can correct me. But the reality is that it is hugely successful. Now, when we first started fighting nukes back in the 70s, people would say to us, well, you want to stop nukes, what are you going to do for the power? And we'd say, solar, wind. We had no idea what we were talking about. But there was, thankfully, a Toward Tomorrow fair that was held in Amherst, Massachusetts in 1975. And there are two guys there, very important. One was named William Hieronymus. William Hieronymus, who's since passed away, had this vision of these huge windmills offshore. And everybody laughed at him like he was Gyro Gyrus. They were going to be 5-megawatt windmills. And he had the drawings and the whole deal. And they poo-pooed him. They're happening now. General Electric is making 5-megawatt windmills to go offshore. One of the major costs on offshore windmills is getting the post into the ground, right? You got to go through all that water. But his vision had them floating. They were anchored to this ocean, but not with but with chains, not with with posts. And if they can do that, you know, it's going to take off. The other guy at the conference of great importance was this little guy named Amory Lovins. Anybody heard of Amory Lovins? Amory Lovins is the great guru genius of renewable energy. I love him dearly. I've known him since 75. And he made all sorts of crazy predictions. He said somewhere in the 90s or early 2000s, there'll be hybrid cars. Who could imagine that in 1975? Hybrid cars. Can you believe that? And if you're interested, I really highly recommend Rocky Mountain Institute, rmi.org. And everything Amory says is 100% true. He is totally reliable. And he built a house in Snowmass, Colorado, where it's really cold outside of Aspen, and it has no heating unit. It's just totally solar heated. He has banana trees in his living room. So this all, back then we had a vision. I actually came up with a name for it in 2005, Solartopia, a totally green-powered Earth. We talked about it in 75. It was actually coming on in 76, 77, 78 when Carter came in. Carter had his faults, but he did have a vision of green power, and he did set up the National Renewable Energy Lab. And then the apocalypse occurred named Ronald Reagan. And anybody want to doubt the damage done by Ronald Reagan, I can tell you that he set us back a good 20, 25 years on renewable energy. There's absolutely no doubt about it. You know, ripping the solar panels off the roof of the White House was the least of what Reagan did, as did George Duke Majan here in California. It's horrifying what they did. And luckily for us, and it's hard for many Americans to understand this, there are other countries in the world. And the technology was picked up by Denmark and, you know, Danish, and the Japanese did a lot of solar, the Israelis did a lot of solar, and then the Germans, although the Germans basically took over Denmark's technology. And so where we had, with Jerry Brown, 17,500 windmills in California in the early 1980s, I knew Jerry Brown back then, by the way. I haven't seen him since. I have this vision of walking up to Jerry Brown and saying, Jerry, last I saw you were governor of California. What are you doing now? But Anyway, he did a great thing, by the way, and I think I got a call on this. When they first put up the windmills here, they put up a bunch at Altamont Pass, right? You all know where Altamont Pass is. Those were bad windmills. They were small, they were fast, they killed a ton of birds. And, you know, it proved that if you really work at it, you can kill birds with windmills. The big windmills, they don't kill birds, maybe one a year. Your car kills more birds than the average commercial windmill. But the ones at Altamont Pass were really bad. They were in a migrating zone. They had lattice tower and fast blades. And so then the opponents of wind power would take the numbers of birds killed at Altamont Pass and spread that out over all the windmills in the world and prove that windmills would kill every bird on Earth. So when Jerry came back in, to his credit, he got those windmills down. They're out putting up better windmills out there. So it proves that, you know, not everything we do that's green is 100%. We have to be careful about this. I will tell you right now, the photovoltaic cells, PV, the panels that convert sunlight to electricity, will be the biggest industry in the history of the world. There will be photovoltaic cells on every structure on this planet. There will be photovoltaic cells on every automobile, every vehicle, every device, every computer. Everything will have photovoltaic cells. Yeah, maybe even our false teeth. Well, that would be a good one. So, but, you know, it will be there and it's on its way. The major decision we face actually in the world right now is by far the highest number of projected commercial atomic reactors are slated for China. It's about 36 on the drawing boards in China. And no one else is even close. I don't think anybody else is in double figures even. Russia and India, I think they're both under 10. And nobody else, the French are done, we're done. They're now on the brink of opting to go totally solar. And don't think that there's not a grassroots movement in China. There's a lot going, a lot of power. A lot of, you know, they had a revolution not too long ago. And there's a lot of grassroots opposition to nuclear and to pollution in China. So whatever we can do to urge the Chinese on, we need to do. It will happen. I also want to mention hemp. And for that, I'm going to put on my final T-shirt tonight. This is the favorite T-shirt I ever did. This is Pot-Smoking Patriots. This is George Washington, Ben Franklin, and Tom Jefferson all smoking marijuana, which is highly credible, actually. George and Tom both raised prodigious quantities of hemp. They raised a lot of tobacco. They hated tobacco is really hard to grow. They didn't like tobacco at all. But George imported large quantities of seed from India, and Tom just wrote, about how much he loved raising hemp. And hemp was the number two cash crop in America before and during and immediately after the American Revolution, number one being tobacco, which was the more dangerous drug. So now with the prohibition on marijuana finally starting to end, hemp will come in. And hemp will be a much larger cash crop than marijuana ever was. And it'll be multi-billion. Ben Franklin is on here because his first paper mill used hemp paper. So we will have hemp, paper, clothing, bird seed, of course, oil, food. And so as prohibition goes away, it will impact the renewable energy industry. We also will have biofuels. Let me talk about biofuels very quickly, and I'm going to wind down here after we get through Solartopia. Biofuels are an extremely important part of the renewable energy mix. But we cannot make biofuels from corn and soy. It makes no sense whatsoever. We cannot use food crops to make fuel. We can't have people competing with hunger against automobiles. And plus, they're lousy sources of ethanol anyway. Corn is bad for ethanol, and soy is a little better for diesel fuel, but we need to use hemp oil and other forms, other crops. But biodiesel, biofuel will be very important. We will also have wave energy. Wave energy is one of my favorite. They basically take a giant metal sausage and they have it split in the middle and they go up and down and it squishes water and creates energy. We also have essentially underwater windmills. There's one off in Norway and it's way more powerful than wind-driven windmills. Wind is irregular. Water and currents are way more powerful and way more reliable. And if we can solve the problem of corrosion from salt, those will be very big. You'll have them off the coast. We'll have them off the coast here. We also have ocean thermal. We have geothermal, and mass transit. God willing, we'll finally get some mass transit in this country, and increased efficiency, conservation, things like that. So to conclude with that part of it, we are on the brink of what I consider the most important technological revolution in human history, which is the conversion from King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, to Solartopia, a totally green-powered Earth. We have the technology, and it's economical. That's the turning point that we face now, that we welcome now. All these technologies, which were once pie in the sky and which were considered too expensive, are now cheaper. They're cheaper than coal. They're cheaper than oil, for God's sakes, and they're cheaper than nukes. The only thing competing with renewables now is fracked gas. And fracked gas is a nightmare, as I don't have to tell you all. And I just want to conclude by saying, as we go to Solartopia, as we go to a green-powered Earth, and as we win this, and we are winning it, now I'm in the position of telling you that perhaps our number one ally in the conversion to Solartopian technology is Wall Street. Thank you. Because, you know, there is a faction in Wall Street that's invested in fossil and nuclear fuels, but it is shrinking radically. The big money is going into renewables. So the bottom line is this. We are on the brink now. And in my world, I live my life every day praying that we get to Solartopia before the next meltdown. It is a race. And so as we move to Solartopia, let's move to good-paying jobs. Let's move to a social justice situation, which is so much a part of this whole tradition here, this meeting house and this wonderful group of people. And just take heart in all the progress we've made, and remember that our survival is at stake here, as well as our economy. And let's move it. So thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That was the conclusion of a speech by Harvey Wasserman on how the green-powered Earth Revolution can defeat King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas. I recorded him in Berkeley, California, on August 6, 2014. In over 40 years of anti-nuclear activism and green, renewable energy practice, Wasserman has authored and co-authored a dozen books, countless articles for publications from Counterpunch to the New York Times. He teaches college-level history, does a weekly radio show on PRN, and has an active presence on the internet that you can access through his website, solartopia.org. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.